This is exactly right.
Forgive me for interrupting. I'm Bridger Weiniger, host of I Said No Gifts on Exactly Right. Each week, I invite my favorite people in comedy over to chat, and they always bring a gift. We're coming up on our 200th episode, and every episode is a gem. I have welcomed all kinds of great guests, including Cola Scola, Bowen Yang, Robbie Hoffman. It goes on and on and on. And you don't want to miss the 200th episode with the great Maria Bamford. What does she bring me? Find out April 25th. New episodes every Thursday. Follow I Said No Gifts wherever you get your podcasts.
Stare directly into my balls of eyes, because this is my favorite murder.
Hello and welcome to the true crime comedy podcast that you turn to in your hour of need.
Or your hour commute.
Or your hour of, maybe you're getting a massage and you thought, this will be funny.
Oh, that's weird. This will be stupid. Are you cleaning your house from the party you had last night? How was the party?
Are you cleaning your house from the fact that you never clean your house like me, where I looked down today as I was watching TV and there was like a sand dune of dog hair on the ground, where I was like, what in the?
That's disgusting. You want to hear something really gross?
Super gross.
Like a couple weeks ago, I got a peel on my face, you know, a professional peel. And so you like shed like a snake for the next week. And I look down in the bathroom and it's just like my fucking dead skin.
<Your face. laughs>
Disgusting all over the
pieces of your face on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
That's my favorite Avril Lavigne album.
Hey, that's Karen Kilgariff.
That's Georgia Hartstark.
Because sometimes you guys can't tell our voices apart still.
And I bet you can't now too.
But you're correct, whatever you're guessing.
And it doesn't matter.
It doesn't also matter.
Remember.
Oh, I remembered my corrections corner from last week that I couldn't remember.
Right.
It's this. The week before,
mm-hmm.
I said, oh my God, you guys send your DNA to 23andMe and then send it into the place where, like, killers, you can,
right.
You know,
you had
let's
a whole
all
plan.
Get our DNA.
You had a DNA plan for everybody.
And then I got a bunch of messages, including from the Dollops, what's his face?
Dave Anthony
saying, don't fucking send your DNA to public places because in, you know, Trump's future, they're going to use that to deport people or to deny people fucking healthcare because of pre-existing conditions based on your DNA. So if you're at all paranoid about that, don't do it.
Yeah.
If you're like me and I'm just like, well, the end days are coming and nothing's going to matter and the fucking system's going to shut down anyway. So the DNA is not going to be stored anywhere. Do it.
What?
You know what I mean? Because like, there's not going to be a system anymore. Like the...
Why? Because they're turning off all the electricity?
Everything's going to get shut. Power's going to go off.
And then everything's going to defrost.
Mm-hmm.
And all the little beakers that the DNA's in are going to fall off the shelf.
Well, if there's no internet to upload the DNA results to.
Right. No, it'll just be a big filing cabinet on a hill.
Yeah.
And then you just go and spit into it. No, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, like, let's not implicitly trust some kind of technology and go, this is the answer.
The thing to remember about this podcast is that you shouldn't listen to us.
No, we're just trying to have a private conversation. I don't know what you fucking people are doing hanging around.
You keep butting into our private conversations.
And then there's this guy with the mustache recording us.
And then there's three cats here that are just like, what?
Like,
shut
just
up.
Just sitting around going, when's my line?
Yeah.
Okay, we're trying to talk to each other.
Karen and I have been trying to have a private conversation for like almost three fucking years.
For borderline 3 years.
And we've never had one.
No. It's getting worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. So full apologies if you've been taken into the Trump regime. That's not even funny. I was starting to say that as like a riff. It's too real.
Uh-huh.
Let's not say the word anymore. Let's not go into that area. We're here to escape mm-hmm. into murder mm-hmm. and away from reality.
Speaking of, I'm going to plug our new fucking merch line, our new, like, what's it called when it's not going to go for very long? Seasonal.
Short-term
seasonal merch line that we're really fucking excited about. It's finally coming out. It should be out today, which should be Thursday. We started a summer camp line.
Yeah.
Which is like, it's like a summer camping line with a with three new logos and one, three new designs, one that you already love, the Stand of the Forest one, on new merch. And there's like a fucking camping mug. There's t-shirts, like all kinds of cool different t-shirts. It looks like you're in a fucking summer camp.
Yeah.
Put on by My Favorite Murder.
Yeah. It's really, really cute.
It's really cute.
There's some really cool things.
Yeah. There's the
and
koozies.
It's very contradictory. We tell you to stay out of the forest.
Yeah.
And now we're basically giving you set up to go into the forest.
Yeah. I'm really, the logos or the designs are really fucking cute. There's like three different ones. They're all different. We're excited about it. So go to myfavoritemurder.com, then go to the store, you know, have fun.
Shop around. Get a look for summer. And it's, you know, it has been a while, so you can update your MFM look.
Yeah.
Oh God. Why did I just say that? Hey, listen, I have a reader. I don't know what this is even called, because this is like a new thing.
Listener mail.
I wouldn't call.
Is it that?
Yeah.
Listener mail.
Yeah, and now you have to do that every time.
Oh my God, it gives me a headache.
I love it. Yeah, what you can't see is Georgia flung her head from mm-hmm. left to right as she sung listener mail.
I'm basically doing Janice from The Muppets going, I'll trade anyone who has a jacuzzi. Which is my favorite line from anything ever.
I just realized that as you did that and said it, Janice from The Muppet reminds me of Lizzie Cooperman.
110%.
That's so funny.
They're the same person.
I love it. Okay. So this is a message from Chelsea. I won't say her full name.
Clinton.
She says, Corrections Corner Molokai. I argue this is not a Corrections Corner, because okay. I'm sick of being fucking corrected. Hi, ladies.
Fair enough.
Just listened to episode 129. Loved hearing about Karen's trip to Kauai as well as our own serial killer story. Mm. I'm born and raised in Honolulu and I'm very familiar with the Ke'ehi Lagoon and adjacent Sand Island area, because it's a heavily used recreation site used for water sports like jet skiing and or canoe paddling.
Not canoeing.
No.
Specifically canoe
just
paddling.
Just the paddling part. There's no enjoyment of the movement or the scenery. The story was super creepy, but knowing the area, I'm not surprised it happened there. It's not a dreamy location, but rather an industrial zone that's right next to the airport. Mm. Planes literally fly over all day.
Scary.
That's really funny. Oh, and anyway, I just wanted to help with a little fact you were sharing about Molokai. Molokai has a population of 7,345. I like that she's saying all this, like, because she's from Hawaii, she knows the population of Molokai.
Yeah.
We all have the internet, Chelsea. But the remote part of the island you mentioned has a population of 11.
What?
And it's actually known. Oh, this is the corrections part. Got it. It's actually known as, now I have not had a chance to look at the pronunciation.
But you've done great thus far.
I mean, there's a lot of heart and a lot of sincerity in it, but also this is going to be wrong. Kalaaupapa, the historic leper colony.
Mm.
The Catholic Church, including Father Damien, who...
he's the dude who went there, got to take care of everyone, right?
Yep.
Got leprosy and was like, fuck it, I'm going to take care of these people.
That's right. Because they were completely just shipped onto that island and like, there was no law. There was nothing was set up.
No medical.
It was just shit. If children had leprosy, they got shipped there and they were just left to their own devices.
And this amazing man. There. Yeah. He was like, I'm going to go. I'm going to take care of these people.
Father Damien, we heard all about him in Catholic school. Catholics love to talk about Father
Damien.
He's
your guy.
Because he was, I think, if they haven't made him a saint already, they were like putting him up for sainthood in the 80s.
Cool.
So he played a large role in the history of the city, which is probably how your family is connected to the area. No, you're incorrect. Last, so now you have a corrections corner,
I correct
Chelsea.
You.
You're wrong.
It's fun
let's,
to correct
Let's
the
get
correctors.
Everyone to talk about how you're wrong.
Yeah.
Sorry. I've imbibed a little bit of cold brew.
Oh, right.
The last remaining residents in Kalaaupapa, that was definitely wrong, are all over the age of 75. Mm-hmm. And I believe there's less than 10 left. I'm hoping this will help your listeners understand a small but significant part of Hawaii's history that you also have a connection to. Wrong twice. Strike two. Thanks again for sharing about my home and great job with your pronunciation. Oh, no. Aww. Your effort did not go unnoticed. Mahalo nui ke hau. So I bet her middle name, like her Hawaiian name is Chelsea. I mean, is ke hau. And Chelsea is her email name.
Got it.
Thank you, Chelsea. That was awesome.
That's so nice.
And I love the idea that people would be canoe paddling in a creepy airport lagoon.
I just like imagine like gasoline on the layer on top. And, you know, like when you're canoeing and you're smoking a cigarette and you throw it overboard, the whole fucking ocean light's on fire.
You light the lagoon on fire. That's when the really cheap dads who like have a problem with spending money, they're like, you're going to Honolulu, but we're staying at this place that has its own lagoon.
God, like, those motels.
Dad, no, dad, please.
I stayed in those as a kid with my dad. It was very depressing. Well, I have a, you are correct. I have a, Karen is a fucking psychic and so smart. Corrections corner.
Shit, we should have started with that so I wasn't going to be so defensive.
No, no, but now you're going to feel better.
Okay, great. That's what we're all looking for.
Oh, I knew that was going to happen. I'm so sorry. Can we talk about the best day of my life?
I don't think we can talk about it.
We can't say what it was specifically.
Okay.
Karen and I did a voiceover thing for something that's going to come out in a while, which of course we'll tell you about when it comes out. But we went and we recorded these voices and I was like, doing my little voices. It's very scary. And then the person who's recording goes, hey, Georgia, can you burp on command? And honestly, I was like, of fucking course I can. And I did it twice. And like, I got home and I kind of had this emotional moment of like my whole life. And like, as a kid, I was weird Georgia and embarrassing. And like, my brother and I would learn how to burp on command. Mm-hmm. And it was just this moment of like, I was so proud of myself.
Yeah.
Like, called my mom and told my mom. And she was like,
Mom, I burped on command, so fuck you.
No, she was proud of me.
That's good.
She's like, you've been practicing forever. Okay. Karen, Georgia, Associates.
Beautiful.
I love it. Karen, this is from a guy named Mike. Karen, I don't know if you did this on purpose, but right after you were talking about Nietzsche, Georgia said something about time not being real, and you said time is a flat circle. If you rewatch that scene from True Detective, which you said it was from, you will hear McConaughey say, what is that, Nietzsche? Shut the fuck up. Right after Reggie Ledoux says time is a flat circle.
No way.
And then he writes in a... asterisk spooky ghost noises. Stay sexy and don't read Nietzsche because he's incomprehensible and annoying. Mike.
Mike!
We basically wrote True Detective from the future.
Well, also, I recently rewatched season one of True Detective, but I've only gotten up to the scene that's one long tracking shot where he goes in and like, that fucking, I think it's like episode 3 or 4.
Yeah.
I wonder if that was in my weird, like that was filed away in my brain. I didn't know I was saying
that. Or you're psychic, which I think is something you always want to prove.
I definitely want to be psychic.
Yeah.
So you're right. Stop saying what the reason might be and start accepting
100%
Mike's beautiful compliment.
If Mike's not right, who is?
No, Mike's always right. Here's the thing about that guy. He pays attention.
Pays his bills.
He pays his fucking bills on time. Which, what guy do you know that's like that? Mike won't allow red bills.
Uh-uh.
And he's a detail man, but he's not in your face about it.
No.
You know what I mean?
No, he just says associates. And you're like, that tells us what it is, but it's also funny.
Mike, I have to tell you, Karen, Georgia, Stephen, and Associates is probably my favorite greeting so far.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
So, Mike is right.
You're number one.
Yeah.
Mike is right.
Wait, hold on. Should we close this?
No, it's...
Okay, you like it?
I'm good.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
Well, and also, you have to remember... So, guys, it is in LA, of course. It's in the 90s. It's July. I keep having to remind myself. I'm like, it's so fucking hot. It's like, it's summer in Southern California. Stop complaining. But... I realized why I was complaining so much today. My AC went out.
Ugh.
Like the fan was still running, so I didn't notice.
Oh, yeah.
So then at 1 o'clock, I was just asleep. I just went to sleep because it was, when I got up and checked, it was 83 degrees in my house.
Fuck.
So this place feels like
this is nice.
An ice box. It's amazing.
Karen, you've been huffing that Freon. You run out of Freon?
A little bit. It gives me beautiful dreams.
When I go to sleep at 1.
I just want gold on my face. So this is actually a really cool thing. So we talked about last week posting pictures from tour and hotel rooms and loving hotel rooms.
Yes.
We got this from a bunch of people on Twitter.
Thank you.
And this email that Stephen just printed up for us from Nicole in the Gmail box. Hey, ladies and Stephen, while listening to your latest episode, I remembered hearing about an app called Traffic Cam, TraffickCK. Cam that you can use to take pictures of a hotel room to help human trafficking. And I also realized I keep forgetting to use the app whenever I go away to stay in a hotel.
Yeah.
So the idea is that you take photos of your hotel room, upload them to the app, and then law enforcement can compare the room images to images advertising potential victims. And that way they can find where those rooms are and where potentially those people are being trafficked. She includes a link to a CNN article about it. Just thought you guys and others would want to know about the app. I think it's a great idea, and hopefully it works to help human trafficking victims. Love you guys and your podcast, and hope to see you next time you come to the Boston area. She actually wrote SSDMG, Nicole, which I like. Thank you, Nicole. That's thank you and everybody who tweeted us. That's such a mind-blowing, like, that's the good tech that's coming.
I wonder if it's worked at all.
Well, it must, right?
Because
why would they start it?
A whole app about it. I want to read about the stories that it's worked on.
Yeah, that's really cool. Traffic cam. If you, for some reason, take pictures of the hotel rooms you stay in, go over to Traffic Cam and see if you can't upload them and help people.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
That's our new thing.
Hey, here's the thing. We talk about this all the time. But join the fan cult.
Oh, yeah.
There's lots of cool things coming your way, fan cult members. We're trickling them out slowly. And as you know, we're not the most organized people on the planet. A little busy and a little bit like we're going to do it next week.
Yeah. But there is shit on there that you can't get anywhere else, like videos. We do unboxing videos of gifts. We're going to do like...
And we have a bunch of gifts waiting because we're waiting to do these unboxing videos.
Yeah, but neither of us ever show up to this podcast with makeup on because we just work all day on our... murders
and sleep in the heat. I resent the fact that I need in this late stage in my life to get put on makeup for these videos, but we really have a lot of cool stuff and cool ideas coming for you, so just know that there's lots of plans in the work for the fan cult people.
So if you just go to myfavoritemurder.com, you'll find our new merch line, you'll find all this bullshit, you'll love it, it's the best. Goodbye. No.
Why do I always remember lyrics to songs, Karen, that I haven't heard for years, but I always forget my email passwords?
I know, right? It's like our brains only want us to retain useless information, but with 1Password, that problem solved.
1Password is an award-winning password manager that's trusted by families and large-scale companies alike.
If you're tired of being the person that everyone texts for a streaming login, hand that honor to 1Password. They let you share logins with people and with groups.
With 1Password, you can securely switch between any device type or operating system. That means if you're a family or business that uses both Mac and PC, you won't have trouble sharing your private data.
Don't let the name fool you. 1Password does more than just store passwords. It can autofill usernames, payment details, and personal information. And they notify you about potential data breaches.
For business operations, 1Password has a dedicated support team that will integrate its security tools into your existing workflow.
1Password saves everyone time. And we all know that time saved equals money saved. Your accounting department will thank you.
Don't just listen to us. 1Password was named Wirecutter's best password manager, and companies like Salesforce and IBM trust 1Password to secure their most sensitive information, so you can too.
Right now, our listeners get a free 2-week trial at 1Password.com/MFM.
That's 2 free weeks at 1, as in the number 1, password.com/MFM.
1Password.com/MFM.
Goodbye.
There's something about the sound of an old-timey cash register that really takes me back.
I know. It sounds like someone is about to hand me an ice cream cone, but it also sounds like we just sold some merch.
That's right. And if you're a Shopify user like us, you know that this sound means you just made a sale.
Shopify has helped millions of businesses sell their products online, but did you know they also offer the same support for brick and mortar stores?
From accepting payments to managing inventory, they have everything you need to sell in person. So give your point of sale system a serious upgrade with Shopify.
Shopify POS tracks sales across all your locations. That way, you'll always know what you have in stock and where.
They also provide reliable tech that fits your unique retail needs, like turning a tablet into a credit card reader.
And if you're looking to reach new customers, check out Shopify's marketing tools. They're easy to use, and they integrate with all social media platforms.
With Shopify, we have a powerful partner for managing our sales. And if you're a business owner, you can too.
Do retail right with Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period today at shopify.com/murder. And here's the important note, that promo code is all lowercase.
So go to shopify.com/murder and take your retail business to the next level.
That's shopify.com/murder, Again, don't forget, the code is all lowercase.
Goodbye.
Is that it?
Yeah, you're first this week.
Okay. Well, I thought it'd be really fun to do this murder, and I didn't realize that. So we're recording on Sunday because I'm leaving for Hawaii tomorrow. But tomorrow, so this week, this comes out, but specifically Monday, is the 100th.
You keep saying if this comes out. Like, you're not positive.
I mean,
Stephen, will you just promise Georgia right now that you will put this up tomorrow?
I swear.
Okay.
I mean, for Thursday.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. 100, so it'll be 100 years this week since this murder.
Exactly. Whoa.
And I didn't realize it at first.
That wasn't the reason you picked it?
No, it was because I had started it and I was halfway done with it already. And didn't like the murder I originally picked. So I was like, how far along am I in this one? Great. But this is actually one that I wanted to do for a very long time because it truly is one of my favorite murders.
Okay.
I'm fascinated with it. And
I just can't tell you how many documents I have of half written ones that I bail on it. And then I'm like, I'm going to go back to that.
Well, this one was hard because there's so much work that needed to go into it. But I'm going to leave a lot of shit out and piss off a lot of history people.
No one's here for history.
Okay, great.
No, you can't be at this point. If you're here for history still, you're a sadomasochist.
Yes. This is the story of the last of the Romanovs.
Oh, shit, girl. We're going all the way back. Wait a second.
We're doing
this
it.
I love this so much. And I just recently, when I drove home to Petaluma for Father's Day, listened to Last Podcast on the Left's series on Rasputin.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
So, which, you know, lays into
touches
this a little bit.
This,
so
sure.
I love it. This
They're
is so
perfect
good.
To do Rasputin.
Yes.
I'm doing fucking Romanovs. I am not Last Podcast on the Left. I do not have the studying skills of our friend
Marcus Parks. He's a serious man.
Yeah. So fuck, like, this is one of my favorite historical stories because it is so fucking insane. The whole story is bananas, and yet as I'm going to be reading this, and I didn't realize it too, it's like you can see a lot of modern day similarities to what happened and what could happen, and it's really scary.
Yeah, because, well, time is a flat circle, as Mike told us.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it's true, like, that the reason it's a cliche is history just repeats itself. And these things, it's like the power dynamic keeps happening.
Just because shit's in black and white. And listen, when I was in high school, I was like, this boring story. I wasn't interested in this at all. And then when I got older and, like, saw some, you know, History Channel video about it and started reading a book about it, I was like, this is way more fascinating than I thought it was.
Yeah.
So, okay, the House of Romanov, it's the second dynasty to rule over Russia. It starts in 1613. We're going to get through this history part.
Numbers.
Yeah.
Also math.
It's math. I hate it. The Romanovs had ruled Russia for five generations and were so powerful that they believed themselves to be ordained by God as absolute rulers. So think of, like, the fucking British royal family. That's going on, but in Russia.
They all think they're ordained by God.
Yeah.
It's little nuts.
I don't
think God's into royals. He's more like Lord, where he'll never be royals.
Peasants. He wants peasants. Mm-hmm. He's like Lord. Exactly.
God is like Lord. Sorry.
All right. They're rich as fuck. They build mansions in the grandest royal palace in all of Europe. They reign for centuries with unlimited power, et cetera, et cetera. What?
Well, I just have to say, I put my finger up to stop Georgia once again, and she's barely started.
No,
and the
I love
look
it.
You just gave me was so good. You're like, what?
No, I thought you were going to make fun of me for saying et cetera, about an entire fucking dynasty of royal people. Okay, great.
Of course not.
I just need to look. I don't need to tell you guys this shit.
I was just going to remind you that in high school, during the Cold War, 1987, I went to
That's
Russia.
Right.
I went to old school Russia. And so, like, I've been to Peter the Great's summer palace.
Wow.
And I am telling you, these people weren't just rich. Like, the summer palace, which wasn't their main palace.
It was their summer palace.
It was the most incredible thing I've ever seen in my life to date.
Oh my God.
And everything about it was, like,
ornate,
breathtakingly large. They had a fountain that had, I think it's, who's the guy from the ocean?
Triton.
Triton? Is that what you just said?
Or is that from,
Yeah. Well, like, that's the thing he holds. What's
right.
his Neptune.
I'm thinking
right,
of
Steven?
The Little Mermaid. Yeah.
They had a fountain of the Little Mermaid. But it was a thing that was probably five stories tall. Like, it was like triple the size, yeah, of any fountain you've ever seen.
Okay, so now imagine being a fucking peasant who lives in a fucking hovel, survives on bread all day, barely has any money for
shoes.
No shoes, no money for fucking food. And of course you're going to think that these people are fucking ordained by God. They've never seen anything like this in their lives.
That's right.
And that makes sense too, why all the churches and shit, people thought the people who ruled the churches were fucking ordained by God, because look at these insane buildings they made. Anyways, it's crazy.
Yeah.
All right, so now let's get interesting. Tsar Nicholas, who looks like a fucking hot Brooklyn hipster, mm-hmm, with the light blondie beard and the little zoop on his... He's cute. So Nicholas is only 24 when he inherits the throne upon the unexpected death of his father. Alexander III dies of kidney disease unexpectedly in 1949. When he's 49 in 1894. All right. So imagine at 24 years old being, oh, fuck, I'm
in charge.
I'm in charge now. And imagine also being a little kid and seeing your grandfather, who was the Tsar, get blown up to fucking smithereens and an assassination.
Oh.
And then they're like, now you get to take over that job.
That happened in front of the family?
In front of the family, including the little kid, Nicholas. So he's like, I don't fucking want this job. And he hasn't since he was a kid. But now he's getting it at 24 when he's totally not ready. So he definitely doesn't want to do it, but he has to. Okay, so just a week after the funeral of his father, Nicholas marries his longtime fucking gal pal, who was only 12 when he met her and he was 16.
Oh.
Like, were they boning? I hope not.
No.
Yeah. I think they like fell in love with each other.
It was more formal back
then.
Yeah,
you're right. You're right.
So it's like a light hand touching.
Yes. Gloved hand touching.
It's all gloves. Then the gloves come off.
The night of the wedding night. Nicholas marries a beautiful German princess, Alexandra Fyodorova. Nope. Fyodorovna. Mm-hmm. He marries her and they're like, supposedly, like, this is fucking, they're really, really, truly devoted and in love with each other in a way that, like, I feel like a lot of princes and princesses and kings and queens aren't. They're just like set up for marriage, you know?
Yeah.
But they're super stoked on each other. She's also the favorite grandchild of Queen Victoria of the UK. They were coordinated in 1896 in one of the most lavish ceremonies of its time. Fucking sign me up to go to that.
I mean, the bonbons alone.
Little tiny sandwich tables. I love it.
Come on.
So, and then I wrote a thing where, like, you know how they say that when the bigger the wedding, the more likely the marriage is going to fail?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I bet the bigger the coordination, the more likely the fucking ruling is going to fail.
Good parallel.
True in this case, as we shall see. That's foreshadowing.
Okay. Got it.
Alexandra, so she is like, fuck this shit. She doesn't want to go. She doesn't do the traditional social duties that Russia's Tsarina and the Russian people expect from the Tsarina. They see her as distant and severe. The couple has 5 children. They have to have a boy so that the boy can take over the throne.
Yeah.
And so imagine how their 4 oldest, Olga, Tatiana, Maria, and Anastasia feel. They're like, nope, 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 nope. Shit, we have to keep having babies. Finally, they have their son, heir to the throne, Alexei. Fucking, this kid is like everything to them. All Alexander wants to do is hang out in the palace and be with his family. He doesn't want to lead.
Same.
He doesn't want to rule. 100%. You get to hang out in this fucking gorgeous palace with the love of your life and you're like probably fun children.
Yeah.
Great.
And then just be like, who wants a grilled cheese sandwich?
Yeah.
Let's get one.
They'll get made for us, even. We don't have to make them ourselves.
That's right.
Or do the dishes.
We just call down through a can.
A can of sardines.
Because it was in the 1800s.
Mm-hmm. String.
And then a bunch of sardines run downstairs and make a sandwich. Train sardines.
Train your sardines, everyone. Da, 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 da. I'll really hang out in the bay. Okay. He wants to ignore the widespread famine throughout his land and not deal with all this bullshit.
Sure.
According to historian Simon Sebag Montefiore, Tsar Nicholas II was astonishingly arrogant and had contempt for the educated political classes. So he wasn't into the politics shit either.
Okay.
Or the people who were in charge. He was a vicious anti-Semite, mm-hmm. which I think everyone fucking was then. And he had an unshakable belief in his right to rule as a sacred autocrat.
Sure.
And he's not trusted by his ministers. And he also leaves a lot of his dad's harsh, crazy rules in place. So nobody likes him. No one likes his wife. And then there's also Bloody Sunday, where on Sunday, the 22nd of January, 1905, in St. Petersburg, unarmed demonstrators are fired upon by soldiers of the Imperial Guard. Now, we can easily think about this in our society here. Like, this shit could happen.
It's happening now.
It's fucking happening now. It's happening
every day.
It's bananas. Yeah. So,
because also the other things you're mentioning of, like, that thing where people being virulently hateful toward smart people.
Yeah.
Like that thing, which is definitely happening in this country. And I think people are kind of just waking up to it, but it's that thing of like, you resent yeah. people having an education, maybe because you didn't get one for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But that thing, like loving your own ignorance and then hating someone else for actually being smart is yeah. such a, it's like this human failing.
Right.
And it's, I don't know. It sucks.
And there's no debating it. You can't debate with a fucking stupid person that they're being ignorant.
Right.
You know, or no. not being open, or at least not, you know, studying all sides of the story.
No. Yeah.
Mom. Janet. God damn it. Okay. Sorry. I'm very hateful right now. Okay. But they fire upon, it's like Kent State. They fire into the fucking crowd.
Yeah.
It's debated how many people were killed by soldiers, but the moderate estimate, it's like around 100 people were killed.
Shit.
But 1,000 were wounded, both from the shots and being trampled in the panic.
Oh my God.
So all these people are hurt and killed. A peaceful protest.
And they're protesting starving to death?
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. So
revolution.
The people are fucking pissed. By 1914, with the outbreak of World War I, the people are fucking over the Romanovs. Like, no more, dudes. Russians criticize Alexandra and her German heritage because they're super patriotic. Oh, sounds familiar. And Nicholas's mismanagement of Russia's social, political, and economic problems because he was fucking bad at his job and didn't want it. In 1915, Nicholas also assumes personal control of Russia's military forces. So he fucking laters out of his St. Petersburg castle to oversee the Russian armies fighting World War I, goes to the fucking front lines and pretends to be like in charge of the fucking army and sure. shit, which is like pisses people off. But then this leaves Tsarina Alexandra in charge of Russia. And this is where our fucking friend Rasputin comes in. It's a fucking total piece of shit.
Yeah.
So Alexandra's most trusted advisor was illiterate, self-proclaimed faith healer Gregory Rasputin from fucking small-time Siberia.
Yeah.
You know?
The remotest of Siberia.
You know?
Yeah.
Rasputin is seen by some Russians as a mystic, a visionary, and a prophet, and by others as a religious charlatan, and they call him the Holy Devil. Alexei, the heir to the throne, the little boy, has hemophilia. Mm-hmm. And so Alexandra, they're highly religious, Orthodox Russians, highly religious. And so she keeps trying to get these faith healers to come and fix him. And finally, Rasputin comes and no one really knows why, except maybe Marcus Parks does. And I just need to listen to it. Something happens and she believes that Rasputin is healing her son. Mm-hmm. So she fucking brings him on into their highly secretive, like, you know, clique. And
there is actually a part and there isn't any specific thing like mm-hmm. like to know, except for that he did do something mm-hmm. when that little boy was bleeding,
right,
and healed him in a way that people can't explain,
right?
So he really did weirdly earn his spot,
but then he was there for years and years and years, so he must have been like doing something else too.
Yeah, he had weird eyes and yeah. I think people
and
liked
big
that
dick too, right?
But he also smelled
smells terrible.
Smells terrible. You can get the full Rasputin download on Last Podcast.
I think there's a smell-o-vision of it too, where they let you smell him.
It smells like rotten carrots.
Oh,
and deceit.
Eggshells.
Oh,
and deceit.
Weird breath.
Okay, so Rasputin's sexual escapades and immoral behavior, he just like flaunts his dick all over town. He's like the original fuckboy, I think.
Really?
I don't know. I made that up. But yes, he's like fucks everyone and calls it like he's giving them a divine fucking fucking.
Of divine fucking.
And makes them holy and shit. But so the Russian people hate how much sway he has over their country. They're pissed off about it because under his influence, Alexandra becomes paranoid and reactionary. Government officials are appointed and dismissed at a whim. Sounds familiar. Based on Rasputin's prophecies, and Alexandra adopts repressive and oppressive policies. In December of 1916, Rasputin is assassinated by a group of conservative people who oppose his influence, and this left Alexandra alone to rule Russia, and she tightened the grip on authority, and so she's just being a dick too. At this point, Russians are like, fuck this shit. That's a quote. From February, from February to March, Russia is paralyzed when over half a million workers strike and protest. And
that's crazy.
It's crazy.
500,000 people peace out on their jobs.
Public transportation stops. Newspapers go out of print. The number of striking workers increased when rumors circulated of another cut in bread supplies. Uh-huh. So everyone's fucking starving to begin with. All their fucking kids are being sent off to war that they don't even want to be in. 10 million soldiers desert.
Whoa.
And join the Bolshevik uprising. And Lenin begins to emerge as leader of the resistance, which is a fucking fascinating story in its own. There's a really great documentary about Lenin's rise to power. I highly recommend it. And I don't remember what it's called.
Could it be called Lenin's Rise to Power?
I bet it is. Like, you think the documentary filmmakers would be like, you know, I have a great name for this.
Yeah. But it's called, like, Red Tears on a Sunday or whatever. You're like, no one's going to know what that is. They're going to think it's about you too.
March 1917, less than 3 months after Rasputin's murder, masses of pissed off peasants and factory workers take to the streets of St. Petersburg. Police and soldiers are like, great, we're with you. They fucking mutiny and join these motherfuckers because they're pissed off too.
Everybody's pissed. Yeah. Everyone's starving but the royals, right?
Exactly. So the government ministers and bureaucrats abandon their positions because they're like, oh shit, we better get the fuck out of here, right? So this is the February Revolution of 1917. Following this, the Tsar is like, oh shit, okay, I'm abdicating on behalf of me and my son, please leave us alone. He thinks it's going to guarantee safety of his family.
To just be like, okay, I won't be the...
I quit.
Yeah, Tsar anymore.
I quit. He calls uncle. How do you say uncle in Russian? Great, he does that. On March 1st, 1918, once the communist Bolsheviks are in power, the family, they get, you know, they're held prisoner in a couple different places. They finally are moved to Ekaterinburg. It's near the Ural Mountains, and it's this home that they'll be kept in. It's a
pretty nice home?
I don't think so.
Okay.
It used to be like the home of a captain, and then they're like, get the fuck out of here. We're holding the Romanovs in here.
And they're like, oh my God, I'm claustrophobic. There's only 10 rooms in this house.
Exactly. Yeah. So, it's called the House of Special Purpose.
Oh.
Which just makes me think of the jerk. Like, what's your special purpose? Right?
Oh, that's so funny.
Okay, so they're kept in the...
I wonder if that's where he got it. Fucking Steve Martin.
Steve Martin.
You're smart and... That's what you like to do. I did it too.
I like it. they're kept in this home in strict isolation without any of their possessions. I think they had their dogs there, though, which is cool.
That's nice.
They're guarded day and night. There's two, like, high walls surrounding the property for their imprisonment and for the security from the angry townspeople who were like, let's kill these people.
Yeah.
The windows in all the family's rooms are sealed shut and covered with newspaper, and they're forbidden from looking out the window. It sounds incredibly boring.
Yeah.
They're required to ring a bell every time they want to leave their rooms to go to the bathroom. And the guards eventually total around 300.
Jesus Christ.
So you got to imagine. So the four daughters are now 13, 17, 19, and 21. And there are around 300 guards who fucking hate their family.
Yeah.
And there's rumors of, and you have to imagine that they were sexually assaulted at some point.
Sure.
For sure. But they don't talk about, everything I looked in, I've only heard that in one, story.
It kind of stands to reason, but...
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. Alexis, the boy, was 13, but the daughters were 17, 19, 21, and 22.
Okay.
In July, when the White Guard, which is still loyal to the Tsar, they begin to move onto Ekaterinburg, and they might take the city over. So that's, this is what is surmised as the reason for what happens next. In the early morning hours of July 17th, 1918, the royal family is, they're all awakened and around 2 a.m. in order to get dressed, and they're taken down to a 20-foot by 16-foot like semi-basement room in this house. And the pretext for this move, they tell them like, oh, the anti-Bolshevik forces are approaching. We're taking you down here for your own safety because we might be fired upon. So the family is like, oh my God, we're close to safety. We're going to be like saved. They go down there. Tsar Nicholas, who's 50, the Tsarina Alexandra is 46, and their children, 13-year-old Alexis, 17-year-old Anastasia, 19-year-old Maria, 21-year-old Tatiana, and 22-year-old Olga, along with the family's personal physician, Eugene Botkin, and three of their servants. What?
Eugene Botkin. What a nerd. Get that nerd out of the basement.
And three of their servants, all who had voluntarily stayed with the family, which is pretty insane. Anna Demidova, Alexei Trump. Nope. Alexei Trump. And Ivan Karatomnov. Karatomnov. Some one of his like fucking descendants is so mad at me right now for getting that name wrong.
It's Karat Dognov.
Karatomnov. Karatomnov. Mm-hmm. Okay. So little do they know. So they're seated in this basement. They get chairs for the Tsarina and Alexei, who's, of course, frail from his hemophilia, has been for his whole life. Little do they know that standing in another room is a firing squad that had been assembled and is waiting for the command. It's seven communist soldiers from Central Europe and three local Bolsheviks, all under the command of Bolshevik officer Yakov Yurovsky, who we fucking hate. Boo. He's a piece of shit.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
It's said that Yakov secured the order of execution from Lenin himself, but of course there's no paper trail, so we don't know that for sure.
Anything could have been going on.
Exactly. When the family gets into the basement, they're all seated, and Yurovsky simply says, Nikolai Alexandrovich, in view of the fact that your relatives are continuing their attack on Soviet Russia, the Ural Executive Committee has decided to execute you. And that's when they fucking realize they're all going to get killed.
Shit.
Nicholas, he's stunned. He barely has any time to react before the executioners, they draw the revolvers and the shooting begins. Nicholas is the first to die. And I have a book that halfway through about the murders, and it's really graphic and says everything. And I had to stop reading it because I got dizzy.
But it was so bad.
Yeah. So you can read that if you want to. But essentially, Nicholas is the first to die. Anastasia, Tatiana, and Olga, and Maria survived the first round of bullets. I think they got like one in the leg and one in the arm. And it's because as they're shot at, the bullets are deflecting off of their bodies because they are wearing over 1.3 kilograms of diamonds and precious gems that they secretly sewed into their undergarments.
Oh, right. When they left?
Before they left the palace.
Oh, fuck.
So they're fucking deflecting the bullets, which is like almost worse. You know?
But you mean because they continue to live while they're being attempted murdered?
Yeah. Like they don't get a quick death.
You're right. But also if you were shooting them and then seeing bullets deflected, wouldn't you be like, wait, maybe they are like from God and like I was wrong this whole time?
Well, apparently, so this is like an insanely botched execution, and apparently they were all shit-faced drunk too and not experienced. The weapons were just like given to them randomly. It's not like they were good at their jobs even, which is disgusting. But so they get some protection from the bullets and then the bayonets.
Oh, no.
The remaining executioners, they start shooting chaotically until the room is so filled with smoke and dust that no one can see anything and they can't hear any of the commands amid the noise. They realize that the gunshots are being heard by the neighbors. Like, they're in this fucking little town square. There's like other houses around. So the men are told to stop firing and kill the family with their gun butts and bayonets.
Ew.
So the family and the servants are stabbed with bayonets and shot at close range in their heads. The execution lasts about 20 minutes, and at the end of it, once everyone's dead, the dynasty that had ruled Russia for over 300 years is fucking over.
Wow.
So the bodies of the Romanovs and their servants are loaded onto a truck and taken to the Koptyaki Forest. You have to scream the last part of that. Koptyaki Forest. The truck gets stuck in an air. They're supposed to take them to these mines and drop them out of the mines, but the truck gets stuck in the mud near the Gorno-Oralsk railway line. So the men are fucking exhausted and drunk and over it, and they refuse to obey orders. So Yurovsky's just like, fuck it, let's bury them in the road where near the track where it's stalled. So the bodies are laid out and stripped of their clothing and valuables at a place called Pig's Meadow.
Oh.
I know. And then they're all put in, the bodies are put into a grave that was dug, and then their sulfuric acid's poured on top of them, and then their faces are smashed with the rifle butts and covered with quicklime to prevent identification.
Jesus Christ.
I know. The burial's completed at 6 a.m. on July 19th. But it's, so, you know, half the population, people don't like the Tsar, but they didn't want their whole family to be killed.
Right.
But it was, and people still believe in the Tsar too. So it's, they don't want people to know what they did. And then, you know, they tell them that only the Tsar and the heir, you know, Alexei have been killed, and everyone else is in hiding. But of course, it's not true. For more than 60 years, the fate of the Romanovs is debated, and it's not totally known what happened to them. A woman claiming to be Anastasia, Anna Anderson, said that she was Anastasia and she had survived, and she actually knew intimate details about the Romanovs family, maybe. And people believed her story. Do you remember this?
Because
it was the late 90s when she was proven wrong.
Yes. I love that story. Yeah. Well, also, there was like an actual
the
Disney
movie and shit.
Cartoon, but it's the cool. Any scam like that.
Yeah.
There's also the one where the girl came and pretended to be a princess. It's they just found her on the side of the road, and
right.
She was like, "I'm a Tahitian princess or wherever."
Yeah.
It's like some tropical island princess.
Yeah,
and she scammed a bunch of people in England. I think around the same, like, you know.
You're into that.
Back when there was no TV, there was no way to communicate quickly.
Right.
So if you wrote a letter of like, that's not who that is, it would take 4 months to get there.
And by then you fucking sewn all your jewels into your underwear.
That's right. As long as you're charming and convincing, people would just be like, sounds good.
Yeah.
I think you are a royal.
And want her to be that. Like, they didn't want the children to be dead. So
no.
People wanted this to be Anastasia. And she fucking did look like her. And they got, so then what happened was, there was a trial that is the longest trial in modern German history to determine if it's Anastasia or not. And they got this like crazy forensic handwriting analysis dude. And I think it was a woman. And she was like, it's totally Anastasia. Like, she fooled even her.
Wow.
Yeah.
So she knew her stuff, woman, Anna.
Yeah. Or she just got lucky and people wanted to believe her.
Yeah.
But the trial failed to determine if it was her or not. She died in 1984 and still insisting she's the princess. Several other people reported to be the Romanov children throughout the years. And then the burial ground remained undiscovered until May of 1979, when local amateur sleuth and retired geologist Alexander Avdonin and some of his fucking bros located, everyone's looking for this fucking grave.
Yeah.
They locate the shallow grave after years of covert evidence gathering and studying the evidence. So this is 1979. They find the grave. They find three skulls from the grave, and they try to get people to fucking DNA test them and shit. But everyone is, this is not a time when you can be doing shit like this. So they were worried about the consequences.
Because it's now almost the 80s in Russia, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and the consequences were imprisonment, possible death. So they fucking rebury the skulls.
Oh, no.
In 1980. And are just like, we'll be quiet until there's a time in our lives where we can go back and dig them up.
Holy shit.
Isn't that insane?
Yeah.
If you just knew where the fucking Romanovs were.
But you could, there's nowhere to send any. There's no like.
Yeah, no one will test them.
Yeah.
So in July of 1991, so it's fucking 11 years later, 6 months before the final dissolution of the Soviet Union, a commission appointed by Boris Yeltsin to investigate the murders, they finally exhumed the remains from Pig Meadow. But the problem is that there's only 9 skeletons found, and there's supposed to be 11 fucking bodies. So DNA confirms that the smashed skulls and bullet-ridden bones were those of the Romanovs and their servants. But two of the children's bodies, including Alexei and either Anastasia or Maria, aren't found with their family, which of course leads people to think that either the nine bodies aren't the Romanovs and their servants, and or Anastasia and Alexei are still alive, which likes all this crazy speculation. And it makes the Russian Orthodox Church refuse to recognize the remains as those of the Romanovs. So they refuse to fucking bury them in a, you know, official Russian Orthodox
sanctified grave.
Grave and ceremony and shit. And they're sainted. So like this it would have been a big fucking deal. So they are interred in July 98. And they're referred to by the priest conducting the service as Christian victims of the revolution rather than the imperial family. They refuse to acknowledge them as who they are. So finally then, necrosearch is involved in the search as well. And there's a chapter in the book that I love, No Stone Unturned, about the Romanovs and the search for them. It's really cool. But in July of 2007, another amateur group of local enthusiasts found a small pit near where the bodies were initially found containing the remains of Alexei and his sister, Maria, located in a small bonfire site not far from the main grave. So it turns out that Yurovsky had separated the Tsarevich Alexei and his sister Maria, turns out it's Maria, in an attempt to confuse anyone who might discover the mass graves with only nine bodies, which fucking worked.
He did it on purpose. Wow.
Alexei and his sister were burned, their remaining charred bones thoroughly smashed with spades and then tossed into a smaller pit. And despite overwhelming forensic and DNA evidence, the church has refused to recognize these remains as belonging to Alexei and Maria. And for several years, the boxes containing ashes and a few bone fragments, that was all that remained of the children, was just sitting in a shelf in the Russian state archives. And in 2015, those bones were finally judged authentic. Wow. So this fucking week marks the 100th anniversary of the execution of the Russian royal family by the Bolsheviks, one of the most shocking events of the 20th century. During his reign, the Russian Empire went from being one of the foremost great powers of the world to economic and military collapse under the rule of Nicholas II. And even so, people still debate whether or not the assassination was deserved or was just straight out fucking murder. Mm-hmm. And that's the story of the Romanovs.
Wow.
They still haven't gotten their Orthodox burial.
Yeah. Wow. I love that story because then it just makes me want to read a book about Russia is so huge, insane. The history is beyond belief.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, my family, right before World War One, or when World... No, wait, sorry. My family, when World War One was started, was run out of their town in Russia.
Oh, really?
Because they were Jewish. Their town was burned to the ground. And then my grandma, who was 7 at the time, and her family lived in fields trying to survive for the next 7 years.
Shit.
Until they were finally able to escape and come to great Los Angeles.
Your grandma was an exiled Russian Jew.
7 years old, living in fields. Her mother picked potatoes during the day for money and would steal one potato. They'd eat the potato. She had like 6 siblings. They'd eat the potato for dinner and the peelings the next day for breakfast.
Fuck.
Some people who were sympathetic would let them sleep in their barn, but they had to keep moving because Jews weren't. There was another pogrom just constantly.
Yeah. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, so.
I didn't realize it was that close to you. Like that it was your grandma.
Yeah.
Is that your bigger dummy's grandma?
No, that's Molly. She had the same thing, but in Poland.
Look, I'm sorry about what's been happening to you Jews for the past 2,000 years. It's pretty fucked up.
Thank you. On behalf of all the Jews, Karen Kilgariff, we appreciate it.
Really?
Yeah.
God, I love you guys.
You would let us sleep in your barn.
Oh my God.
I don't know about Stephen.
No.
Or Stephen's like, what the fuck?
Stephen, what is your heritage?
I'm half Mexican.
What's the other half?
I think like English or something like that.
Yeah, English Mexicans. I feel like the Mexican side would be like, yeah, we get it. We've been through some shit.
Yeah.
Those English, though, man.
They don't get it.
They love to colonize. They love to oppress.
When did you guys come here?
I think my dad's side came over, like, the Midwest, like, when, like, they were all, like, coming out after, like, not the Pilgrims or anything like that.
No, from Mexico, though.
Oh, from Mexico. even my grandma grew up here. I call her Glendale Mexican because she grew up here.
Like, that's Armenian. Are you crazy?
My mistake. Yeah. Even my mom's side, who's Mexican, has been here for a long time.
Okay. So. Oh, okay.
Cool. Well, shit.
Guys,
look and listen and have a can of wine.
that was good.
Georgia, have you ever been blown away by the most simple dish at a restaurant? Like, perfectly scrambled eggs?
Oh my God, yes, Karen. And then all I want to do is make that dish at home and eat it every day.
Well, you probably could, as long as you have the chef's secret ingredient, Made In cookware.
Made In was created to bring restaurant quality performance kitchenware to home chefs around the world.
For years, they've built their business by supplying restaurants and top chefs with high-end cookware. Some of Tom Colicchio's most treasured dishes at his restaurant Kraft are made in Made In.
Whether you're cooking for professional critics or just the critics you live with, your meals will benefit from the quality of Made In products.
Like their carbon steel cookware, it combines the best of both cast iron and stainless steel clad, so it's rugged enough for grills or an open flame. It's the MVP of summer cookouts and cook-ins. What I really love about Made In cookware is that it actually makes something like having a Memorial Day barbecue much more convenient, because you can keep everything on the grill. If you need to throw, say, a pan of garlic up on the top while you're grilling your steaks on the bottom, it's strong enough, durable enough to do that.
If you want to take your cooking to the next level, remember what so many great dishes have in common. They're all made in, Made In.
Save up to 25% this Memorial Day from May 18th through May 27th when you visit madeincookware.com.
That's M-A-D-E-I-N cookware.com. Goodbye.
I just want to share one of my favorite memories of being in Cold War Russia when the Iron Curtain was still up.
Sardines?
And yet we were high school students that were just like, hey, what's up? Yeah. We've got a bunch of money.
International incident. It's just like waiting to happen.
So it was like, it was very, you know, communist Russia while we were there. Uh-huh. There were like these big, we would stay in these big, huge hotels that were relatively empty, that yeah. looked like they were built in the late 1800s or something.
Oh my God.
Like huge, tall ceilings. And it was really insanely picturesque and gorgeous. And at the same time, surreal
Odd.
And bizarre.
Yeah.
But my favorite night, and I think I've talked about, like, we got lost on that, the Moscow subway, which is gorgeous. It looks like the whole thing looks like a museum. Mm. It has chandeliers and this gorgeous tile. And we were drunk and we got lost. And then some Russian soldiers just found, like, brought us back. We don't know how how they knew where we were staying. It was super crazy. But one time we went to a bar and it was just like, there was just a sign that said bar in Russian, essentially. Oh, and downstairs, and then you go in and everything was exactly the same color. It was like this dark brown gray. Mm-hmm. And it was just all old men, nothing, everything was just dark brown and gray, everyone's clothes, mm-hmm. the whole bar, the paint on the wall. It was just this weird thing.
Yeah.
So we walk up and I'm about to order us all like six vodkas, you know, because we were allowed to drink, because we were all, you know, of age in Europe. My friend Jennifer Gearing, who's the funniest person of all time, goes up to the bar, leans up and goes, hey, can I get six vodka Collins? And like the guy behind the counter does not speak English. They don't have fucking Collins mix.
Yeah.
I mean, like everything about, I was like, go sit
You're
down.
You're embarrassing me.
You're embarrassing me in communist Russia. Go sit down. It was fucking hilarious.
Vodka Collins is our new murderina drink of choice.
Right? Can I get like six vodka Collins? And it's just a guy that looked like he was out of Central Casting.
And was hated just like, you guys.
Not yet. Okay. So my story this week is one that we haven't done yet. It's super famous. People ask us to do it all the time and then ask us why we haven't done it.
Great.
And it's another one of those ones where it's like, I'm going to save it for a live show. No, I want to do it at a live show and it's so depressing and I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
Because it is the hideous. And I am telling you, if you have any issues or triggers around molestation, incest, sexual abuse at all, you do not want to listen to the story because it's fucking terrible. It's the story of Fred and Rosemary West.
Oh, yeah.
It is.
It's a good one.
It's so, like, I've attempted to do this story, I think, like, four different times, and every time I'm just like, this is awful.
I want to hear it, and I don't have those triggers because I'm a fucking monster who likes terrible things all the time.
Right.
But I can imagine you doing this at the London show and it just going quiet.
Yes.
But then they're like, why didn't you do it?
I know, it's such a weird balance, but it's also like, yeah, for live shows, we need to be able to talk to each other and, yeah, like, at least have a semblance of a good time and, yeah, interaction. And this is some of the darkest shit of all time.
Well, I must not know all the dark shit then, so tell me.
Yeah, it's crazy. And but the good thing that I was happy about is early on, I tried to do a recommendation and tried to reference this show called, it was a I think originally it was like a TV show in England, starring Emily Watson, called Appropriate Adult. Mm-hmm. And it stars Emily Watson. It's Dominic West, who is from The Wire, but mm-hmm, he's a British, amazing British actor. And then this incredible actress who I still can't get over her performance. She plays Rosemary West, and her name is Monica Dolan, and she is so fucking good. I don't have a picture of her. She's so fucking good in this thing, Inappropriate Adult. So Emily Watson plays, well, essentially, there's a thing in England. It's when they have a person that's essentially like a citizen social worker that just is there as the witness to make sure that the person, when they're being interviewed by police, is being treated fairly.
Mm-hmm. Victim's advocate.
What's that?
It's a victim. Oh, you mean, but it's a murderer advocate.
Exactly. It's like basically, and it's usually either for children who've been arrested or for people who are like somehow have maybe a learning disability or something wrong with them. But they bring, you know, this woman in to be this, I believe her name was Janet Leach, and it's a true story. So when we get to that part, I would 1000% recommend Appropriate Adult.
I'm watching it.
It's available on iTunes.
Dude.
And it's in two parts. So, but it basically goes into, once he's arrested, and it goes into the insanity of like how the whole case kind of unfolds. So anyway, that's part of where I got this whole story. But and then there was an article in The Independent written by Will Bennett in October of 1995, where I got a bunch of information. Cool. So we'll start with Rosemary West. Unlike anyone in any, I just can't, like, when you talk about this woman, you see a picture of her. Stephen, would you pull up a picture?
I know. She's like super motherly, right?
Yes. She looks like every mom from the 80s.
Totally.
Like the really big glasses and like just a short kind of reasonable hair.
Yeah. A little frump zone.
She's in the frump zone for sure.
She's had some kids. She's lived, like, she just doesn't care.
Eight kids. She's like, yeah.
Holy fuck.
Yeah. So she just looks like the average lady, yeah, walking down the street with her grocery
bag. And no shame on the frump zone. Like, I have frump zone.
I'm the mayor of the fucking frump zone, so don't worry about it.
Great. Yeah, this photo of them is just classic.
She took her glasses off for the photo.
It just looks like they're on a Sears couch with the best wallpaper I've ever seen in my life in the background. It looks like the fucking canvas we have in the
Odd Loft. Yes, and they use that in Appropriate Adult. They have her sitting on a couch in front of that wallpaper. Like, so they clearly tried to recreate the house as it was. And this house is so fucking creepy.
She looks cute. She's got her little, like, Dorothy Hamill haircut. He looks like if Jermaine from fucking Flight of the Conchords, like, really wanted to go all out and play like an ugly, gross dude, don't you think? I think Jermaine Clement is hot as fuck, don't get me wrong,
but no, he is,
he looks
for sure
like a leisure suit Jermaine.
It's like if Jermaine on Halloween trying to be a monster.
Right.
Essentially.
Right.
Because he does look a lot like, he looks like a Muppets monster.
Yes.
Essentially.
Yes.
His teeth are crazy. He has like unibrow, but small eyes, and he looks like he's up to no good.
Totally.
That's also why he's so fascinating in Appropriate Adult. You get that sense of what a true psychopath he is.
I bet he had like a crazy laugh.
What?
I bet he had like a crazy laugh.
Oh, maybe.
Like an unexpected. something you wouldn't expect.
Like the kind of laugh that would make you leave a bar.
Right.
No matter how many vodka Collins you had waiting for you.
It would like kind of jar you.
Yes. So, okay. So Rosemary was born Rosemary Letts in Devon, November 29th, 1953. And of course, it's all of these, they're both of their backgrounds, tragedy right. from jump. So Rosemary's parents, he actually calls her Rose for the most of the time. Both of her parents suffer from mental illness. Her mother, when she's pregnant with Rose, falls into a deep depression and they give her electroshock therapy.
Ooh, with a baby.
With the baby. So there's lots of theorizing that there was prenatal injury to her, probably definitely in the brain.
Yeah.
So because when Rose is growing up, lots of aggression, lots of temper tantrums. Mm. She's a terrible student. The parents have a terrible marriage. Her father, Bill, is a paranoid schizophrenic.
Oh, fuck.
Yep. So he's super violent and he is terrifying. He is just this awful presence in the home to the point where the mother moves herself and Rosemary out of the house. In their adolescence, Rosemary moves back into the house.
Oh, honey.
And it's around the same time. So she hits puberty and becomes obsessed with her body and her developing body. She has a brother that she walks around naked in front of all the time that she begins to engage in incestuous acts with.
Hey.
She essentially, it's not happening out of the blue. It turns out her father has been molesting her since she was 13 years old.
Of course he has.
Yeah. And so Rosemary not only is obsessed with sex but she's also preoccupied with older men.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how she ends up meeting Fred West.
Oh,
because
yeah, oh,
Rosemary is 15 when she meets the 27-year-old Fred West.
Shut up.
Yeah.
Ew.
Yeah. So she is a sophomore in high school and he's fucking 27.
Oh my God.
And Fred, one of the worst people ever to exist, uh-huh. as a child, he was beaten and molested when he was 17. He got into a car accident that left him with a limp and a metal plate in his head.
Head injury.
Right.
Frontal cortex.
After that car accident, he was never the same.
Can you imagine knowing someone who got in a car accident or like living with them and being, they're acting really, like that always scares me when people are like, he wasn't acting the same after that.
Yeah.
Like if Vince got in a car accident and then started getting like these rage outbursts.
Yeah.
What would I do?
It happens all the time. It happens to people all the time.
I couldn't, yeah, it's terrifying.
Yeah, it's really awful. Also, I think that he probably wasn't the greatest before the car accident.
100%.
Because he also sustained another head injury when a woman pushed him off a fire escape because he stuck his hand up her skirt.
For her. Can you imagine?
I know.
Whoop,
she's
goodbye.
Like, get the fuck out of here.
Holy
also,
shit.
Also, at some point along the line, he got his own sister pregnant.
No.
I was really trying to make Georgia do a spit
God
take with her
it.
Can of wine.
Not in my own house. Gross.
Not in my backyard.
Only on stage.
So then he moves to Scotland. After all that, he moves to Scotland to become an ice cream truck driver.
Oh, Jesus.
But he comes back to England after he runs over a 4-year-old child.
What the fuck?
So we're on strike 19 now with Fred West.
Can't just put him to sleep.
No good. So in the late 60s, he comes back to England and he gets a job as, of course, a builder. Because for some reason, all of these serial killers somehow go into the contracting field. It is the weirdest fucking thing. I guess it's the independent work schedule, hammers, I don't know.
Easy burial tools and
cement work. So the only good thing anyone says about him is that he's known to be a hard worker, which is like
good for him.
Great.
So he's on coke probably.
Yeah, exactly. Or he just loves fucking nails.
Dig. Yeah.
So it's around this time where he meets 15-year-old
Hi.
Rose.
Hi, I'm 15. Hi, I'm 27.
Yeah. And but she's like, well, I've always had this paranoid schizophrenic molester father.
Yeah.
So
this is better.
That horrible father objects strongly to Rose's having her this relationship with this old man, essentially, with the crazy, crazy teeth. But she basically believes that they believe that they are like psychically connected. And there's this part in Appropriate Adult.
Like psychically
right? is really what it is.
Yeah.
There's a part in Appropriate Adult where Fred, spoiler alert, he ends up getting arrested. Oh. He's in the police station and he goes, oh, Rose is in the police station? And they're like, no, no, she's not here. We haven't arrested her yet. And he goes, no, she's here. And then they leave the interrogation room. And she was there. And no one in the room knew she was there except for Fred. So there is this, they have a very odd, creepy, creepy, creepy connection and thing.
Ugh.
Their relationship starts. He is abusive to her, of course. He's sexually, you know, technically sexually assaulting her and raping her. She's 15.
Right.
But he's also violent with her because he's a violent person. So she's becomes pregnant relatively soon after this affair starts. And she gives birth to their daughter in 1970. Their daughter's named Heather when Rosemary's 17. Fred West already has two children.
Jesus.
From a previous relationship. And at this, around the same,
his sister?
No. No, he's had a different relationship.
Okay.
He's sent to prison for petty theft and for fine evasion around the same time. So 17-year-old, highly unstable Rose becomes mother to now three children all at once.
Well, she has to take over those other two kids?
Yep.
Jesus.
Yeah. And
is that what they call it? Takeover?
It is a full takeover. So Fred, it's two daughters, unfortunately. Charmaine and Anna Marie are his daughters that he had from a previous relationship with a woman named Rena Costello. And so at some point, while Fred is still in jail and Rosemary is taking care of those three kids, Charmaine, one of Fred's daughters, disappears. Uh-huh. And when asked where she's gone, Rose tells people that she's gone to Scotland to live with her biological mother.
Uh-huh.
So when Fred gets out of jail, he comes back and they move from the house that they did live in to the now infamous house at 25 Cromwell Street in Gloucester.
Okay.
And the neighbors know them as slightly eccentric, but nice. People say that they're the kind of neighbors that would do anything for you. And that's because they have no fucking idea what's going on in what is actually and in truth a complete hell house.
Oh my God.
So it turns out Rosemary is a sex worker who is working out of her own home.
Okay.
And they have set up the house. The bedrooms are outfitted with cameras and listening devices.
She's still a teenager at this point?
She is. Yeah. Basically. Yeah. You know,
18 or 19 or something.
Yeah, she's in her late teens, early 20s okay. when all this starts. So Fred can watch these sessions she's having.
Gross.
We'll call them sessions with her clients from afar. Ugh. And in the house. And if that's not dark enough for you.
It's not dark enough for me.
Okay, then one of her clients is her own father, Bill. Uh-huh. Then Fred knows that.
That's dark enough for me.
Well, it gets darker because then Rose eventually encourages Fred to begin to sexually abuse Anna Marie. And Rose would join in that. She is.
What the fuck?
It actually reminds me of the Ken and Barbie Killers, Carla Homolka.
Right.
And from Canada.
Like giving you a gift. She gives him the gift of her sister, kind of a thing.
Exactly right.
Oh my.
It's the insane sexual assault, incest.
Just psychopaths who have no emotional fucking understanding of human emotions.
And it's the thing of when women do that when they're mothers and they do it to their own children, it's this taboo that is truly mind-blowing. You know,
but it's not a taboo to them because they were raped by their fathers too.
That's exactly
so it's
right.
not fucking weird.
Exactly right. Them. That was childhood for them, for both of these people.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
oh my God.
No good. So they then begin selling Anna Marie to pedophiles.
No.
Yep.
How old is she?
At the time, I think that started when she was eight, around the age of eight.
Oh my God.
One, we'll go one darker.
Okay.
The grandfather was a client also.
So fucking Rosemary's gross rapist.
Molesty father.
Dad.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Just the worst. Yeah. This is, so again, for all the people who inquired, this is why I would get to about this part and just be like, yeah, this is the worst story ever told. So eventually, Rose gets pregnant and has eight different children. Five of them are Fred West.
Holy shit.
Three of them are fathered by clients. They're not sure exactly who they are, but
are any of them her dad?
They don't, nothing I read said that, but it could definitely be. There were rumors that some of them were local authority figures. Yes. So, I think that's why this went like it was rumored, but it was never reported for a long time, that things went on in this household for way, way, way too long, because this was basically the sex worker of town.
Yeah.
And so nobody was like...
But it's also like, if this authority figure comes in to, you know, have sex for money with Rosemary, it's not like he knows that other shit's going on in the house. So it's not like he would have looked into it. He didn't look into, you know what I mean?
Right. It's not like they were getting reports and then they were ignoring them.
Right.
But they also were in no way trying to look at anything that was happening in that house.
Sure.
Because they knew at least they were guilty of something.
Right.
And also it was a lot of kind of intense S&M, bondage.
What?
Violent sex. At one point when they live on Cromwell Street, Rena Costello shows up to get her daughters back from Fred.
Okay.
And Rena disappears.
The mom of the two girls, one of whom is ixnay, not around anymore, that mom disappears.
Yes.
Oh my God.
So, okay. So in 1972, and this is when basically it goes from the ultimate depravity within the household and within their own family and their own home. And then they begin to branch out. In 1972, they pick up a 17-year-old hitchhiker named Carolyn Owens. And they ask if she'll be their nanny because they have all these kids and they need extra help. She says yes. She finds them nice, charming, whatever. Sure. And she moves into the house on Cromwell Street. Mm-mm. And after 2 weeks, she tries to leave. Because, of course, it's fucking a living hell and insanity. Mm-hmm. But Fred and Rose go out and they find her hitchhiking and they pick her back up. They get her back into the car. Rose begins to sexually assault her.
What?
And then as she's trying to fight Rose off, Fred pulls over and punches her in the face and she goes unconscious. When she wakes up, she's back at 25 Cromwell Street, gagged, hands bound, she's molested all night by Rose. And in the morning, she convinces them if they let her go, she's not going to say anything to anybody, that it's fine, no big deal. So they fucking let her go.
What?
She goes straight to the cops, tells them what happened. The Wests are arrested. They're charged with assault, quote, assault occasioning actual bodily harm and with indecent assault. But mm-mm. Caroline's too scared to actually testify against them in court. She can't handle going to court.
Yeah.
And so on January 12th, 1973, the West plead guilty, but they're fined £100 and released.
Are you fucking kidding me?
They never serve any time for that assault. And then soon after that, young girls around Gloucester begin disappearing. Most of them come from broken homes or they're single women traveling by themselves.
Yeah.
So no one really hears much about it. Not until 1992.
What?
Yes.
So 72 when they first kidnapped the girls.
Yeah.
To fucking 92, which I was alive then. And it wasn't that long ago.
20 years. These people are kind of just doing whatever.
Are you fucking kidding me?
But here's what's happened. So there's lots of rumors around town.
Yeah.
People know.
Is it a small town? It kind of is, right?
I don't know anything about Gloucester. I didn't look anything up. But it's not big.
Yeah.
It's no London, is what they say in my mind that I'm making up right now. So finally someone goes to the police and says Fred West is raping his 13-year-old daughter and someone needs to do something about it. So social services starts investigating the West family, and this is when it all kicks off.
Okay.
So authorities enter the home at 25 Cromwell Street, and they find tons of insane, obscene paraphernalia everywhere. So it's not just like they have, you know, they have those rooms that are outfitted with the cameras that it, where Rosemary has her clients.
Yeah.
But they have shit everywhere.
Are there photos?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not the photo person.
I'm going to go look.
Do it.
Go down. Oh, rabbit
I mean,
hole.
I've definitely, there's definitely horrible wallpaper. I'll tell you that. There's some, like each room has a different color and scheme and everything where you're like, the person that built this house is crazy.
Is a monster.
It doesn't care about aesthetics at all. So they basically pull the children out of the house and they are interviewed by police and social workers, and they start hearing these insane stories of sexual abuse.
Poor babies.
And emotional abuse, and just, you know, these parents are crazy. So Fred West is arrested for raping his 13-year-old daughter, and Rose is arrested for child cruelty. Mm-hmm. But the 13-year-old daughter refuses to testify against her parents. And so in June of 1993, the case falls apart.
Shut up.
Yeah, once again. But authorities know this, they're really bad shit is taking place. And when they're interviewing all the children, they're trying to find
The first daughter?
Yes, who they said had gone back to live with her mother.
Oh, okay, right.
So their police are trying now to track down Heather West. Fred and Rose say that she left home in 1987 following a family disagreement, but now she works at a Holiday Village in Devonshire, and that they get phone calls from her every once in a while, and they'd actually taken a phone call from Heather in front of the children one time. So that the children also said, oh yes, Heather called home that one time. Mom and dad both talked to her. We didn't. They didn't let us talk to her.
Yeah.
Then they start talking to Heather's friends, and that's when they find out that 1987 was around the time Heather started telling her friends about the insane abuse that was going on in their home. So authorities are putting together that she disappeared right around the time she started confiding to other people what was actually happening.
Yeah.
So then all the younger West children are put into basically the British version of foster care. Mm-hmm. And
which is called foster care.
They call it care.
Care.
Put into care. You have to whisper it. So when the kids start talking to their the foster carers, they start telling the story about if you misbehaved at home, they Fred and Rosemary would tell the kids, if you don't behave, you're going to go under the patio where Heather is. Yeah. And so everyone's like, ding, ding, ding.
Can you imagine if you're foster parenting or foster care? You're a foster carer.
Yeah.
And your kid's like, oh, I don't want to go under the house like my sister.
Like my sister who disappeared.
Chills.
I mean, horrifying. So it's almost like everyone's just going like, oh, what? Sorry, what? Like,
say that again?
It's all like unfolding. Like, oh, these people who look like the most average people.
Boring, even.
Super boring. And then it's like, oh, there's this insane, seamy underside.
Yeah.
So when they go, so they basically, they go in and they dig up the patio. Mm-mm. And they find the bones of Heather West. And this is where basically Appropriate Adult starts at Fred's arrest.
No way.
Where he had taken them to the house, and he's so crazy. And he's talking like, he tells police, yeah, you can come because she's buried in the backyard. Then he changes his story. Then he changes it again. He's doing all this stuff, and he's trying to manipulate Janet Leach, the Appropriate Adult. Mm-hmm. So he's looking at her going, you should maybe check over there, while he's denying that anyone's buried anywhere to the police.
It's almost like he's two different people.
Yeah, or nine different people. Uh-huh. Like, it's truly, truly, either it's super psychopathic manipulation, like he's masterminding it, or he's really stupid and just kind of playing it moment to moment.
Yeah.
It's very hard to tell.
Or that thing where it's like, well, if I'm going to get fucked for this, I want all the credit. So, like, here's some other shit you should go look into.
Yeah, like, you, it's interesting. It's like that thing where does he like the attention? Yeah. Does he like this weird relationship he's trying to build? He's clearly getting her interest because she's just supposed to be there standing there like witnessing things yeah. and making sure the police don't abuse a person who would be,
right.
you know, in custody that
sure.
everybody would want to punch in the face several times.
Abso-fucking-tibly. It might help his fucking stupid looking face.
Too. Knock some teeth back into place. So basically, because of his hints and these things where he goes, he like, maybe we should go down and look in the cellar. And then when they get down the cellar, he's like, no, the spirits are telling me we shouldn't be down here. Yeah. So then the investigators like dig up this entire yeah. cellar. And that's when they find six bodies of women buried in a circle chronologically from when they disappeared. So Linda Goff is found in the cellar and she went missing on April 19th, 1973.
Holy shit.
She was 19 years old and she was a seamstress. She, you know, she was close with her family. When she disappears without a word, her mother starts asking around and the information she gets leads to the West's house on Cromwell Street. And when she knocks on the door, Rosemary is like, oh, you know, we haven't seen her. And then as Mrs. Goff is talking to her, she realizes that Rosemary is wearing Linda's slippers and cardigan. And then she looks and sees that Linda's clothes are hanging on the clothesline. So she's like, I mean, what the fuck?
Explain my face right now.
Just horror.
Horror.
Then there's Carol Ann Cooper, who was 15 years old. She disappeared in November of 1973 on her way to visit her grandmother in Worcester. If it's the Boston pronounced
I
Worcester.
I bet you it's fucking not.
Yeah, I bet it's Worcestershire sauce. Nancy Parkington is 21. She was a student at Exeter in December of 1973. She went home for Christmas and then she went out to visit her school friend at 10:15 on the 27th of December. She was going to catch the last bus home, never seen again.
Do we think that this is all hitchhiking related?
I'm not sure because it's some of these are these people who are traveling. So yeah. then, you know,
I'm not victim blaming but I think hitchhiking was a really normal thing. And to get into a car of a couple, if you fucking watch Hounds of Love, that Australian murder I did that one time. Right.
Or any of these stories.
Yeah. It's like hitchhiking was very normal.
Yes.
And yeah. And they probably had a baby in the car with them. One of their babies.
That's right. You know, the story of the girl who was kept in a box under the bed. The girl in the box. That's how they got her too.
Yeah.
They also found the body of 21-year-old Swiss student, Therese Seigenthaler. She'd been studying sociology in London and she had decided to hitchhike across England. And she disappeared somewhere on that trip. And also a 15-year-old named Shirley Hubbard, who was last seen in November of 1974. She was from a broken home. There was a couple girls who were found in that basement who had been in either foster care or their parents were divorced. And they had started going to the West's house or hanging out there and then disappeared. One of those was 18-year-old Juanita Mott, who that was exactly her story. So those were the bodies in the cellar. And then they had also dug up the garden, which is where near the patio where Heather was buried. And they found Shirley Ann Robinson, an 18-year-old who had moved into the West's house. She started having an affair with Fred and gotten pregnant by him in May of 1978. And that's when she disappeared. So her body was in the garden. So basically the police, thinking that they're just looking for the missing daughter, discovered that basically these two people had been like these monstrous serial killers and sex abusers. Most of the bodies had been decapitated and
dismembered.
Thank you. Dismembered.
Holy shit.
And just clearly there was evidence of torture. This wasn't just like a simple, you know, it was they were the worst of the worst. And the problem is that they have no evidence that Rosemary's tied to any of these murders until they dig up the kitchen floor in the West's old house on Midland Avenue.
Oh, can you imagine if you're there, you're living there and you get a knock at the door and they're like, hey, hi.
Hi, real quick. Sorry, we're the police. Yeah. And
you know, you got a deal on this house.
There's some, there's a reason that you'd feel cold spots around and bad vibes always.
Oh no.
Because Fred's daughter Charmaine's body was buried. So remember when Charmaine disappeared because Fred was in jail?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Rosemary killed her.
Oh.
And then when Fred got out of jail, Rosemary was, she had hidden the body. Fred's the one that put the body under the kitchen floor.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So he, they were in on it together from the beginning.
Yeah.
And they actually had a, there's a documentary about this. There's a, there's lots of documentaries you can watch on the Wests. There's two on YouTube and one of them is about the, forensic dentistry and how much it took, played into this case.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's how they pinpointed the time of Charmaine's death. And that's how they got it to say Rosemary is the one who was responsible, not Fred, because he was in jail.
Oh. Oh, that's good. Combined. Otherwise, they probably wouldn't have, they would have given her a plea to like testify against him. Against or some him. Shit.
Like she wasn't necessarily involved or whatever. And this was like, no, no, no. She was, she had a hand in the killing and she had a hand in this torture and all, you know, all of that.
Holy shit.
So eventually, Rose is charged with 10 counts of murder and Fred is charged with 12 counts of murder. And when they go to trial, so they separate the two of them. When they go to trial, Rose will not look at or interact with Fred in any way. And it basically makes him go crazy. And he freaks out and hangs himself in his cell.
What?
So he commits suicide. He never gets charged with anything because God, he commits suicide in his cell.
I have never studied this murder, clearly.
It's so
or these people, you know.
They're so fucking crazy and the whole thing and his...
What a dick. He fucking hanged himself?
Yeah, but if you watch, like, especially an appropriate adult, his weird connection with her and his weird, like, he defends her in the beginning. He says she has nothing to do with it in the beginning. And then it's just, it's a classic case of that, like, he's the her abuser, but then I think over the years, she became his.
Yeah.
Before his suicide, there's an interview with the police where he's quoted as saying, "You've the murders wrong. Nobody went through hell. It was sexual encounters gone wrong." So he tried to intimate that it was some kind of like sex play where people were, it was voluntary up until the last minute.
You know, that thing where people are getting into getting decapitated during sex.
Right. And also that accident doesn't happen 12 times, you fucking asshole.
No.
Here's the cool part. Carolyn Roberts, who is the hitchhiker who was afraid to testify for her own trial,
the nanny,
came back and testified in this murder trial. And she's the reason that Rosemary West got convicted and is still in jail to this day. She's still alive. She's still in jail. In last July, she was diagnosed with glaucoma and she's going blind. And she said in a quote to the newspaper, "If I go blind, I'm going to commit suicide."
And everyone's like, okay.
Yeah. Everyone's like, that's fine.
The God.
Really weird thing is in 1996, they went to demolish 25 Cromwell Street.
Uh-huh.
The new house. Uh-huh. That's where all the horrible things happened. Yeah. It took them 5 days to knock the house down.
Why? It was made of cement.
If he did so much building and burying and cementing and doing things inside the house, I mean, the whole thing was, it was like this bizarre fortress that they had built and that these horrible things were happening. And of course, the police were immediately like, get rid of that as an entity.
Yeah.
But then it just took them forever.
That's so weird.
It's like they couldn't knock it down.
Yeah.
So that's the quickest, most lightest, like dipping into talking about the important things, but not living in the horror show. But you definitely can. I mean,
you know, I'm gonna.
Yeah. There's really good. I mean, Appropriate Adult is such an incredible, it's such an incredible way to present the story because Janet Leigh is as this person who is like the, you know, mandated witness is sitting there and, you know, also it was her first case as an appropriate adult.
Oh, I feel like never have a first case anywhere because it's always of anything.
I know, but for something like this, you'd think it would be like, you know,
yeah,
just standard physical child abuse where she gets used to it, cuts her teeth. And there's just this amazing scene where when he starts confessing, he's saying it like he goes, well, yeah, I did bury Heather's body under the patio. Like he just starts talking about it like they're talking about the news. And in the background, Emily Watson playing Janet Leigh is just sitting there with her face. And it looks like her face is slowly dropping off of her skull because she's just like, what the fuck? And she's there as his guy.
Yeah.
You know, she's supposed to be his right hand man of like, you're there if the police try to abuse me. You're there if the, and suddenly this is the monster that she has to work with.
Wow.
And then it basically, the story comes out through their relationship where he keeps turning to her and going, you're the only one that, you know, you're the only friend I have in the world. She's like, I'm not your friend.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And she has her own whole life. She has kids that like, she's not getting home till late because she has to work on this case that every word she hears is like, she can't unhear it. And then she goes home and looks at her beautiful children. They're all sitting around the dinner table. Oh. It's amazing. That I think that is like the best way to tell the story is through a person who's life is so horribly impacted. Then it goes into whole things of testifying and her selling her story because she didn't have a ton of money and all the judgments and it's
and all the therapy she's gonna need afterwards.
Insanity.
So crazy.
Yeah. So watch Appropriate Adult parts 1 and 2.
I'm gonna.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
So now we got that done. We never have to talk about that fucking those monsters again.
Karen, great job.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was very.
It has bothered me that I haven't done it just because it is one of the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
And we talk about terrible stuff all the time, but for some reason
it's just weird that we never did that.
It's just so much. It's just so specifically awful.
Yeah.
Really bad.
Well, speaking of the opposite of awful.
Right. Which we always do at the end.
We always try to do.
I have one.
What's your fucking hooray?
I have one at hand this week.
I love it.
And part of the reason last week that I was hesitating so much is because I wanted to do this one. I just hadn't finished the audiobook yet.
Oh, yeah.
So I wanted to wait until I was done.
Okay.
So this fucking book, and I'm make sure I say the guy's name correctly. But I actually think I'm going to listen to it again because the story is so goddamn insane. And it was recommended to me by friend of the show, Billy Jensen. It's called Bad Blood, and it's written by a man named John Carreyrou. And he is a Wall Street Journal reporter. And this story got brought to him. And it is it's called Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. And I don't want to tell you too much about it, but basically when all the dot-coms, the startup boom happened, and it begins around 2007, and it's a 22-year-old Stanford dropout who begins her own tech company, and she's going to start a new type of blood testing system where instead of using hypodermic needles, which she claims to be scared of, she's going to start a finger stick system where you only need a drop of blood and then they can diagnose diseases and tell you what's wrong with you and all this stuff. And she basically takes that concept, gets all this financial backing, and eventually this company gets valuated at being worth $400 billion.
Jesus.
And she is on the covers of all the magazines and all this stuff. Well, the truth of it, the whole fucking thing is a scam.
I love it.
She doesn't have any medical experience. She doesn't have any science experience. She doesn't know anything about this thing. She is such a big, that she's starting a fucking startup for. She just wants the idea of it to happen. So all the scientists over the years that start to come and work for her and to try to build this thing are like, yeah, it doesn't exist already because it can't exist.
Right.
You need more blood than that to test for things. And she's like, basically is like, make it happen. She gets all these people, powerful people on the board.
I picture her as Janice from the Muppets.
She's like evil Janice from the Muppets. Okay. But there's parts of this book it's this thing of how if you have a bunch of money and you're a liar, you're a sociopath, basically, yeah. you can kind of do anything you want.
Yeah.
Because she keeps on convincing people to back her, give her money, and support her while scientists and medical experts go, this isn't real. And her board and all these people go, you're fired. And they just keep getting rid of the naysayers.
Yeah, yeah.
And until...
It's a great way to live your life is just get rid of any people who like tried to help you.
Yeah, look around your life. If you're the kind of person that can't be contradicted or criticized or told anything negative about yourself, and because of that, you cut people out of your life, you're going to have humongous problems.
Yeah.
You have to have those voices. And whether it's in your personal life or starting a business where people's lives are on the line. She had a humongous deal with Safeway. She had a huge deal with Walgreens.
Oh my God.
They were going to set up like these wellness centers in Walgreens where you could go in, get your finger pricked, and in 4 hours they'd tell you if you had any disease at all.
Wow.
That was like the selling point. And she was like, yep, we can make it happen. And all the scientists are like, it's not real.
What's it called? Bad Blood?
It's called Bad Blood.
Right.
And it's one of the best books I've listened to in a really long time.
I love it.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Wait, did I just tell the whole fucking book? Sorry, I didn't mean to.
No.
I didn't mean to go on that long. I just loved it.
That's exciting. I guess mine is that I'm going on vacation tomorrow for the first time in a very long time. But also, everyone go listen to the new season of In the Dark now that it's over. It's really upsetting, but in a good way. And it's a great podcast too. And I'm just excited to fucking lay out and eat raw seafood towers and listen to books and podcasts and just fucking chill. And
this is gonna be so nice.
And like, I don't know, man. It's Vince and I are just gonna chill. My dad and Marty's gonna be here with the cats. It's gonna be great.
Great.
Yeah.
Perfect.
That's it. Everyone needs a little vacay every now and then.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do.
Drink some Mai Tais. Swim up bar. There's a swim up bar where I'm staying.
Sure there is.
I've never done that in my life.
You can fucking swim all around that pool.
I got a fucking bikini or a bathing suit that has bomb pops all over it.
What are bomb pops?
There's those popsicles that look the red, white, and blue popsicles.
Oh, yeah.
It's cute. I'm excited.
That's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you have to tell us all about it when you get back.
I will. Everyone, thank you so much for listening. Email us at myfavoritemurder@gmail.com. Thank you. We really appreciate you guys. This is a really fun fucking time in our lives that we did not expect to happen. And it's all because you guys listen to us and like us for some reason and just keep butting in on our private conversations.
The more we yell at you, the more you stay. It's such a great relationship.
It is.
Yeah, thanks for being there and stay sexy.
And don't get murdered.
Bye.
Yeah. Elvis, you want a cookie? Good one. A cookie? Yeah, cookie.
All right.